Our guest today is Kevin Williamson of the National Review and various other significant publications, and the author of a number of past books of great interest, and now one beautifully titled and indeed surprisingly written. It is titled The End Is Near, and the subtitle tells you a great deal: How Going Broke Will Leave America Richer, Happier, and More Secure. I'm rather reminded, Kevin, of the figure that we still see sometimes on street corners in big cities with signs, and maybe even with little public address systems of a primitive variety, literally shouting to us, the end is near, repent. But you're not calling for repentance, you're calling for celebration. We are to celebrate the decline and collapse of the American government, apparently.
Well, at least the decline and collapse, I think, of the welfare state. You know, the title of the book is The End Is Near, and it's going to be awesome. So the second part is the part that that most people need some explanation about.
Absolutely. But first, how do we know the end is near? We have a very active government full of plans and operations and expanding its functions. Obamacare represents a major transformation of medical delivery, which is about one-sixth of our total economy.
Yeah, if you were looking at it from a time horizon of 1 or 2 years, or, you know, 3 to 5 years, you would conclude that that the expansion of government's right on track and it's going to keep going and there's not much that can reverse it, until you take a little bit of a deeper look into the budget. And then when you start seeing unfunded liabilities for the major entitlements that add up to not trillions of dollars, but more than $100 trillion, when you've got a real level of debt and liability that actually exceeds the economic output of the human race, and approaches the value of all the financial assets in existence, then you can predict with a degree of confidence that these bills are never actually going to be paid, since they represent more wealth than actually exists in the world.
Well, we've had that occur elsewhere. Lately, it's been happening in various lesser European countries, in effect. And governments sort of do go bankrupt, but then they just reconstitute themselves. They say, our debts are canceled and we're back again in business, and here's what we're going to do for you now.
Yeah, actually, we don't have anything that's really a real economic precedent for what we've got in the United States, for a couple of reasons. One is that while other countries have had debts and liabilities that exceed the size of their own economies or of their own holdings, ours actually exceeds the size of the economy of the world, of all the financial assets on the planet.
How did it get that bad?
Well, we just simply made promises and never set aside money to pay for it. And the interesting and scary thing about the U.S. situation is that we've never seen a country that represents a fifth of the world's economy, which we do, in that sort of situation. So there's certainly cause to be concerned and cause to be worried about what that economic friction is going to look like as this comes unwound, although I tend to think that that it's not going to be as bad as some people in the doom and gloom camp sort of suggest. In fact, I think that some really good things in the long run will come out of this, which is what the book is about.
You are, of course, doing something that is quasi-theological. This is a kind of eschatology, being the doctrine concerning final things. And in the Judeo-Christian tradition, certainly in the book of Revelation and so on, we are told what will follow after, in essence, the end of history or the cancellation or reorganization of all of human fate. You're saying a disaster is coming, but it is to be welcome rather than to be controlled. Welcome the disorder that is coming, because after that comes a new dawn.
Well, what I'm saying is it doesn't have to be a disaster. Now, if we continue just doing things the way we are doing, continue down our current irresponsible and unsustainable path, then yes, we will get a very, very bad economic outcome from that, either in the form of a currency crisis, monetary crisis, fiscal crisis, or a general economic crisis. But I tend to think that we'll actually end up avoiding the worst of that. And the reason for that is because even though we've got – defective political institutions, Americans aren't basically stupid. They don't want to be poor. They don't want to be vulnerable. And they know that we've got working alternatives to these sort of monopolistic political systems that we see in place for things like Medicare, Social Security, and at the local level, education, things along those lines. So you get a lot of people around, you know, my age and younger. I'm 40, and people of my generation and the generations after us, I think, have long been reconciled to the fact that things like Social Security just aren't going to be there. I think most of us are counting things like the taxes we pay into Medicare as just a net loss. That's not, you know, this phony investment they've been telling us it is all this time. And we're already looking for alternatives to that. We're already prepared, I think, emotionally and intellectually to be looking for other ways to go about handling our own retirements, handling our own health care, handling the education of our children without the overweening role of the state there in the middle telling us what to do and how to do it and when to do it and on what terms and according to their say-so.
Well, before we look at the non-governmental solutions to the problems that government can't handle, it's a stunning figure when you say that we have national debt and national obligations larger than the total wealth of the world. How did we get into that mess? Step by step, how did we wind up here before people like you began to warn that we are in an impossible situation?
Well, it largely has to do with two programs, which are Medicare and Social Security.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you look at the regular just debt, just, you know, bondholder debt, that's a serious problem as well. It's about $17 trillion at the federal level and another, you know, couple of trillion dollars by the states and cities. So that's a big chunk of money as it is, although if that were the only liability we had, that would be something that's probably that can probably be dealt with if we would slow spending and get a little bit of control on the growth of that going forward. But when you've made promises of future benefits under Social Security and under Medicare that are completely unrelated to any money we have set aside, any money we expect to collect in the future, and any resources we have to put into that, that's where you get this huge thing. I mean, we could promise people, you know, we'd promise them basically $100 trillion in future benefits that we don't have the money for. We could promise them, you know, $1,000 trillion or $1 trillion trillion or whatever. It doesn't really make any difference. You know, you're just talking about a theoretical proposition on a piece of paper that has no relationship whatsoever to any kind of economic reality.
Somehow an old advertising slogan comes to my mind. This is almost irresponsible of me, but there must be some hidden truth in this. A perfume company used to have the slogan, promise her anything, but give her our pish.
Yeah, so we promised them not only anything, but everything. And, of course, that's
what's the equivalent. What's the equivalent of give her our pish?
Gosh, right now it's give them a bill for some fairly nasty national liabilities that are never going to get paid. So I'd rather have the perfume if it were me, even though I'm not really a perfume kind of guy.
But in ancient Rome, when you wanted to placate a mass that was being cheated and has a reason for being dissatisfied, the basic answer was provide for them bread and circuses. Is that some sort of consolation which is presently being provided?
Well, and that's the interesting thing about where we are compared with, say, where the Romans were. You know, during the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire, the government controlled all the trade routes. They controlled the distribution of grain and foodstuffs within the empire. And so poor people were dependent on public granaries for their food. Government had a very, very strong hand in that. In a modern technological capitalist society, things are precisely the opposite. Regular people, economic institutions, consumers writ large have much, much more power than the government does. Their ability to control our lives, to impose on us to do certain things according to their preferences is actually really very low compared to where it was 100 years ago or 200 years ago. And part of the argument of my book is that I expect this to get even more difficult to police people in the future. So as we have more responsibility for dealing with our own lives, we also have more resources for doing it, and we also have a government that has less recourse to being able to force us to do certain things in a certain way.
What will be the premonitory signs of the actual beginning of the collapse of government?
Well, again, I'm not really predicting a complete collapse of the American state or anything like that, although I am predicting a fairly radical retrenchment of it and the disappearance of things like Social Security and Medicare and some related programs. I think the most likely outcome and the most likely warning sign you will see is when interest rates on government debt start to go back up. You know, they're at historical low levels right now, partly because of Fed policy driving interest rates down, but also because you've got investors that are spooked by what's been happening in Europe, that are spooked by the Chinese situation, which doesn't get talked about very much outside of China specialists, and some other things in the world economy. So you're still getting basically a concessionary rate on American debt. So we're paying, you know, basically zero to finance our deficits right now. When you see that number start to go back up, then I think you'll start to see the sort of chain of events I'm talking about come to pass.
What about the external forms of government? Does government persist in its present structure?
I suspect that what we'll be talking about 25 or 30 years from now is a government that does kind of night watchman things, kind of basic, fundamentally governmental activities, things like running the military, running the border patrol, police, courts, things like that. I think you'll see probably very little government involvement in things like healthcare or the energy sector or trying to manage the direction of the economy. I think you'll see much simpler and lower taxes because the government's ability to collect them will, I think, diminish over time. I think you'll see a government that's much simpler and more straightforward than what we have today. I think you'll see less funding for things like Harry Reid's Cowboy Poets Festivals and those kinds of things 10 or 20 years out.
The overall view that you enunciate in this book, and it's a very compelling one, is that intrinsically politics is poisonous to the proper handling and fulfillment of human needs. You seem to be saying that if you do it through political institutions, it's always inefficient. It always essentially gets you deeper into debt, and it doesn't work at all as well as comparable institutions in the private sector, so to speak, which are also intending to meet human needs. Can you illustrate that difference? Can you make this?
Yeah, one of the things I do, I talk to students about this a lot, and I was a professor for a while, and one of the
professor of what, by the way?
I was a professor of writing at King's College in New York, so I taught persuasive writing, and one of the things I use in this talk is a picture of, you remember Michael Douglas as Gordon Gekko in that 1980s movie Wall Street?
I do indeed, and I'm also
every time I put that picture up. Students, whatever their politics are, whatever their backgrounds are, they all laugh. Uh-huh. And it's not because of his, you know, slicked back hair or his 80s clothes, but it's because of that cell phone he's holding. And he's holding this, you know, Motorola cell phone from 1984. It's 13 inches long.
Yeah.
It weighs a little more than 2 pounds. And most people don't know this, but if you adjust for inflation, that thing cost almost $10,000 to buy. It cost nearly $1,000 a month to operate. And, you know, it had 20 minutes of talk time, something like that, you know, maybe 60 minutes of standby time. You couldn't give away a thing like that today. Now, that, you know, only 25 years ago, 30 years ago, not, you know, the dark ages, you had to be a millionaire. You had to be Gordon Gekko to own something like that. Now, every teenager, every student, every person, poor people, wealthy people, we all have cell phones that are much, much better than what even a millionaire could buy back then. And it's not just technology. If you look at the price of food, even though food prices are up over the last couple of years, they're still a fraction of what they were in terms of household income in the 1950s. You look at things like medicine. We've got things that you just simply could not buy, no matter how wealthy you were a short period of time ago. But one of the points I get into in the book is that it's not just for-profit and technological goods. You see also similar kinds of improvement in the nonprofit sector, things like Wikipedia, things like Kickstarter, producing, you know, radical advancements in the usability and affordability of certain kinds of products that you just don't see when they're delivered through politics. So the question I always ask is, you have a cell phone that gets better and cheaper every year, better and cheaper, better, cheaper, year after year. why doesn't the same thing hold true of your schools or your retirement or your access to health care? And the answer to that question is that politics simply can't manage information.
Well, now, the big obstruction that faces your argument, or of your argument, and just to examine present institutional and political reality, is the coming of, dare one call it by that name, Obamacare. Mm-hmm. That is medical or health care provision taken over by government rather than abandoned by government.
Yeah, and well, Obamacare is actually, you know, a really good example of the sort of thing that I get into in the book, which is this idea that you can have a government agency that can rationally plan something in a very complex market. You simply can't. If you look at it just as a plain information management problem, you look at all the variables in something as complex as healthcare in a country as large and diverse as ours, you know, of more than 300 million people, you're talking about you know, the numbers you use to calculate how many variables exist in a system like that are things you have to write out in scientific notation. You know, they are yeah, astronomically enormous numbers. And so you get these people like IPAB, you know, the price-fixing bureau that that Obamacare sets up. Well, we're going to look at all the information, consider all of our options, and once we've done all that, we're going to make rational decisions based on the data about how we deliver health care. That simply is not going to happen. They'll never actually make those decisions because you would need from now until the end of time to actually go through the information.
Well, but how will all that be played through? The fact is Obamacare is there, it is law, and we're told that by next year it will be largely implemented and in operation.
What I expect is just basically anarchy in the markets.
Yes.
You're going to have people cutting off supply to various sorts of goods because they don't make sense in terms of their economic model. You're going to have providers, whether they're hospitals or insurance companies or other sorts of people, who simply will stop offering services because IPAB will try to set the price point at a place at which it's not economically feasible for them to do. You're going to get all sorts of unpredictable and unintended consequences. I wouldn't be surprised if, as a consequence of this, in, you know, 5 or 10 years, you actually see fewer people with health insurance than more people with health insurance, even though the promise of the law was to reduce that number to, you know, essentially zero. You'll see fewer people going into medicine, fewer people investing in things like hospitals, pharmaceutical companies, medical devices, and things like that. So if it's allowed to stand, I suspect what you'll end up with is a substantially reduced quality of health care and substantially reduced access to health insurance and therefore to health care related to that. Although I kind of doubt that the law will ever actually really be fully implemented. I think that if you look at where it is right now, the disorder that's already associated with it, the capital that's fleeing those markets, I think you're going to see a really, really strong pushback against it. And I wouldn't be surprised if it were substantially altered in the very near future, if not entirely repealed.
The general viewpoint with which you're working is that as governmental systems to provide and fill needs, as they fail, as they grow increasingly and visibly inefficient, other institutions arise, not from government, but from private industry, from community life, from, for all we know, religious groups or what have you. Mm-hmm. Other institutions get invented and meet those needs more effectively. What will happen in that crucial realm of medical care provision?
Well, one of the things I always advise people to do is if you want to see what the middle class is going to be doing 10 years from now, look at what the very rich are doing right now.
Uh-huh.
Because the history of our economy is essentially that you get a lot of innovation at the very high end of very, very wealthy people who try out new things. And then as those things get developed, they filter their way down to the middle class and to lower income people relatively quickly, you know, just the same way cell phones went from being a toy for millionaires to something that everyone has in their pocket. So if you look at what very, very wealthy people are doing right now and wealthy institutions like corporations, they are, of course, fleeing from things like Obamacare as quickly as they can, either through doing self-insurance the way very large corporations do, or going, you know, directly to providers the way a lot of people do. You know, very, very wealthy people, if they need a health care service provided to them, whether it's an operation or a doctor's visit or something else, they don't go through their insurance companies and all the rest of it. They go directly to their provider and they pay out of pocket. That actually works really well for a lot of people. You know, there was a story last week about a physician, and I want to say it was California, who's just decided to stop taking insurance and then he'll deal directly with his patients financially. I think you'll see a lot more direct interface between patients and doctors and patients and other medical providers without insurance companies and other institutions standing in the way, simply because that's the easiest thing for most people. In the long run, it's the most effective thing for most people, and that's how functional markets develop. You'll still see people relying on insurance or possibly on government services for, you know, catastrophic things like cancer or getting hit by a bus or needing a heart transplant or something like that. But if you look at where we are right now, for most people, almost all healthcare expenses are covered under insurance, which is this weird kind of bundling effect where nobody's actually paying out of pocket. Everyone's got conflicting economic incentives, and so you end up with a very expensive and dysfunctional system.
Yeah, but now all of those different modes of insurance are somehow being gathered into and under the great supervisory magical system of government control through Obamacare.
Yeah, and I think that as the thing about Obamacare is, I mean, it's essentially designed to abolish insurance. You know, what Obamacare calls insurance is not actually insurance. Mm-hmm. If you can't turn people down for pre-existing conditions, then what you have is not insurance, because insurance is all about looking into the future, not into the past. You can't insure against something that's already happened. So what Obamacare does, it essentially outlaws traditional insurance and changes everything into a kind of managed care product. Now, as those become less and less valuable to people, and they will become less valuable because they will be expensive and heavily regulated and all the rest of it, and you'll have very little choice about the particulars of what's in your plan, since the government is going to say, well, all plans must contain X, Y, and Z, then what you'll see is people basically exiting that system to the extent that they can. If they have enough money, they'll simply go directly to doctors and healthcare providers. And, you know, people will certainly go abroad, as people already do for certain kinds of health procedures. You know, people go to India, they go to Colombia, they go to Brazil. And you'll see more and more of that seeping down from the very wealthy into the upper middle class and the middle class, and people will start to exercise to the extent they can the ability of exit from these dysfunctional markets.
As governments grow increasingly incompetent or increasingly poisonous because everything is handled politically rather than through other non-governmental institutions, and as the government piles up increasing debt and more debt and more debt, and as the general economic disorganization that ensues pushes lots of people out of the economic system into essentially unemployed poverty, we've begun to have in various nations, not only the Arab nations, where the Arab Spring showed up as essentially a great movement against established governments, but also, say, in Cyprus and in Turkey, a Muslim nation to be sure, but also a secularized sort of half-Western nation, and also, and in great marches down the Champs-Élysées, and for that matter in London, we begin to get a sense of revolt against government turning into not merely disdain, but turning into assault, turning into attack, turning into something quasi-revolutionary, at least mm-hmm. in the recourse to violence. Are we to look forward to something like that as the American governmental system really begins to visibly fail?
Yeah, I doubt that very much. You know, the French just kind of like to have riots. You know, if the price of fish goes down 15% in 1 month, you can bet that the docks will be covered in rioting fishermen. You know, the Greeks and the Cypriots and the Italians, they have a lot of political violence there. It's usually low-level stuff, you know, breaking windows and disorderly marches and things like that. We don't really do a great deal of that here. It's not something that that we've got a very long tradition of. I mean, certainly we had a bit of it in the 60s and 70s, but I think that's pretty well died out. I think what you'll see from Americans is more just simple non-cooperation of us saying, well, that's, you know, that's great that you want to do X, Y, or Z, but we just don't think that's where we want to go. And you already see this. You know, I mean, people ignore things like marijuana laws. People ignore things like speeding laws. You know, people who work in the cash economy ignore the tax code. And you don't get anarchy, you don't get disorder from that. You just get the reality that people will only cooperate with government to a certain extent. And if you can get government to focus on the things that it's actually there for, which is providing physical security, really, defending the borders, keeping peace on the streets, then I think you'll get a lot more cooperation from people. Whereas when you've got government trying to do things like decide how much of a profit margin the maker of a hip implant ought to be collecting when he sells one, then people are going to start to see that that's not really, you know, a core competency of what the state is really very good at. So I'd like to see the government refocus on its real responsibilities, and I think that you would get a lot more buy-in from the general public when the government goes sort of back to basics, in a sense.
As I've been reading your new book, The End is Near, and it's going to be awesome. There are some really surprising elements which I've uncovered. I discover that the American judicial system, which in many ways is dysfunctional and really rather annoying or worse, is in some sense being replaced by private courts, so to speak. I discover, of course, and I knew this before, but I didn't know the full extent of it, that with regard to education, public education is to a significant degree being supplanted by education undertaken essentially by concerned parents and outside of the standard educational systems of the cities or of the states. It's as if already alternative institutions replacing governmental performance are becoming increasingly evident in our life, though not fully noted by all who observe. Tell us a little bit about the justice system and its replacement by private institutions.
Sure. You know, if you remember the famous Microsoft antitrust case when Microsoft was accused of being a monopoly and all the rest of that, it was kind of a nonsensical case. But the one thing that really stood out for me about that was the judge in the case, who was an eminent legal scholar by the name of Thomas Penfield Jackson.
Yeah.
But he was, he was a man, I guess, in his middle 70s at that point. And he didn't know how to operate a mouse. He had never sent or received an email or visited a web page or anything like that. And he was the guy who was in charge of this complex technical case against Microsoft and its web browsers. So, you know, if you talk to people in Silicon Valley, you talk to people who work in the tech industry, they'll tell you can tell the difference between an honest patent case and a dishonest patent case by whether it goes to the courts or whether it goes to arbitration. People who have actual, honest, legitimate disputes about a technological issue or a patent issue want that resolved by people who actually know what they're talking about, which is why they go to specialists in arbitration. If they're just patent trolls, just people trying to make a buck with a nuisance case, they always go to the regular courts where you can be sure of getting someone who doesn't have that kind of specialized technological expertise. So you'll often find, not just in the technology industry, but in finance, in other sorts of business transactions, people who have actual good faith disputes about contracts and patents and things like that, taking their cases to private sector arbitration rather than to the court, simply because they want them decided by people they trust and by people who they think have good knowledge and a working command of the specific issues in question. There's no reason why that shouldn't also apply to things like family court, to other sorts of disputes that people get into outside of the realm of relationships between businesses and investors. So I think that's a pretty good model that we already have of taking some functions of what we think is being the inherent function of government, which is running courts and law enforcement and that sort of thing, and taking some of that into the private sector as well, where you can get more specialization, more knowledge, and presumably better outcomes. You get similar things with education, where I'm really interested in homeschooling, for instance, which I think is a really interesting movement of people saying, well, you can have our money, we'll still pay our school taxes, but we don't actually trust you to provide the service that you said you were going to provide.
Yes, and the homeschooling systems certainly are expanding, and that frees the parents from the burden of having to go along with some of the particularly crazy things that educators impose these days, including requiring cross-dressing and trying out the opposite gender as an exercise for kindergartners and so on.
Yeah, it's kind of nuts. The interesting thing about homeschooling, though, is you see a lot of innovation there. You see both families doing things on their own. You see impromptu communities of families. And one of the nice things about the Internet's allowed people to cooperate and communicate all over the world who are working on the same kinds of issues. And then the important thing there is you also see the market stepping in, providing things like curriculums, course materials, other kinds of educational materials. So you get, you know, all the different aspects of what makes a free society really work there. You've got the free market working, you've got families working, you've got communities working, all of them innovating and concentrating on this one goal. Now, homeschooling isn't a model for everybody. It's not, you know, a one-size-fits-all solution. I don't think there is any one-size-fits-all solution. But it is a really good example of the fact that you can take things that people have thought of for a long time as being inherently governmental responsibilities and privatize those things, not just in a for-profit way, but in a way that's very productive and innovative.
There are two questions that I do want to cover, though time is running short. First, a narrower question. How does all of this bear upon American politics of the moment, and particularly the Democrat-Republican division or the progressive-conservative division? Does this augur for somebody winning and somebody losing in that continuing American contest?
I don't really think so. I think that I think, if anything, the good news about all this is that particular tedious, boring exchange between Republicans and Democrats will become much less important to our lives as the centrality of politics to American life recedes. I mean, you know, I'm marginally more sympathetic to the Republicans. I think that they've got better ideas about the deficit and entitlement reform moving forward, although how serious they are about that and how central that is to their message is something that I certainly have reservations about. But I think that, if anything, the really good news is that I think that politics as such is going to be much less important in our lives 25 years from now than it is today.
One other matter that haunted me as I was reading your book is that certain historians who take the long view argue that the modern nation state is really something that emerged only about 200 or 300 years ago, or maybe even less than that. The many different districts that composed what is now Italy were not put together as a nation until the late 19th century. Germany, similarly, was put together only after the many separate duchies and what have you were finally consolidated under dominance from Prussia. But France itself was kind of a modern invention, maybe constructed about 200 years ago. There are those who argue that the nation state represents a phase in a human social or political history, but it has a natural limit and will begin to fade away. Leopold Kohr, K-O-H-R, 50 years ago did a very interesting book titled The Breakup of Nations, in which he argued that quite in a rather premonitory way, that nations were, national governments were losing their effective functionality, and instead many of their functions would be taken over by private institutions or by international institutions. Not totally unlike what you are predicting. What is the future of the nation state, including the nation state of the United States of America?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I used to live in India, and of course India wasn't a single country until 1947. Mm-hmm. And if you tried to explain to someone 200 years ago that it would all be one country and it'd be governed by Delhi, people would have thought you were probably crazy. In fact, I traveled in the far northeast of India and met people living in very remote rural areas who had never heard of the Republic of India. And if you tried to explain to them that there was a parliament of people in Delhi who were ruling them, they would have laughed at you because the idea just seems absurd to them. So, you know, we've already got situations around the world in which the importance of central government is somewhat suspect. I think you'll see a lot more temporary relationships between people and capital, between people and markets, between people and companies, between consumers and producers that shift more quickly than they have in the past, that change more quickly. You know, the average lifespan of a corporation now is about a third of what it used to be. Corporations used to typically live for around 100 years. Now they typically survive for something more like 30 years. I'm trying to remember if I have those numbers exactly right, but I think that's where it is. The rate of change in society is accelerating, and states, of course, have a hard time keeping up with that because they think in terms of, you know, decades or even longer. You know, we're going to pass this one bill and it's going to fix health care for the next 100 years or 50 years or whatever, when in reality things are moving in terms of seconds and minutes and days. And I think that the important institutions in the future will be the ones that can move at that pace, that can move that quickly. You know, when you have a piece of software in your computer, it'll automatically update itself sometimes every couple of days, depending on what you're doing. You need something that moves that quickly in your broader social arrangements as well. And the collection of ladies and gentlemen in Washington, D.C. just simply isn't that.
Well, Aldous Huxley did a book many years ago titled A Brave New World. It was really a dystopian
yes.
vision of a dreadful human future based upon the achievements of science. You are also predicting a brave new world, but not in a dystopian way, but in a moderately utopian way. You rather are optimistic about how social evolution will take over to somehow handle the problems of the present and improve the human condition.
You know, I intensely dislike utopian thinking, and anyone who proceeds along those lines, I think, is almost always mistaken. You know, my particular ideas about where things are going and how to get there are the opposite of utopian in the sense they assume that the kinds of troubles that have always been with us will continue to be with us.
Uh-huh.
But there are things that we actually can do better. You can look around and see the improvements in things like medicine and communication, in various other aspects of our lives, in the food that people eat, in the houses that we live in. And you can extrapolate from that that we do have ways to make the world at least materially much better than it is right now, to provide better for people who can't provide for themselves, to help take care of the poor, the disabled, the elderly, children, other people who can't be responsible for their own lives entirely, that we really can do a better job of that because we aren't poor and we aren't going to be poor.
Well, utopian or otherwise, your vision is in some sense a heartening vision against the tide of contemporary pessimism. I thank you most sincerely for joining us. Our guest has been Kevin Williamson. The book that we've been talking about and drawing from is The End is Near, and it's going to be awesome. Thanks very much for the conversation.
Thank you.
Solar birds against a Swedish sky. The same.